from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At least 430 people have been killed in terrorist attacks in Russia in the last month, a toll that will almost certainly rise as the final numbers for the massacre at the bombed-out school in Beslan are tallied. Today, Russian President Vladimir Putin responded with an order for sweeping centralization of political power in Russia, arguing that was the only way to save the country. Governors will be appointed, not elected. Opposition legislators will be effectively pushed out of the national legislature. And all this by an awkward American ally in what George W. Bush calls a battle of freedom versus terror. Tonight on Point, Russia, terrorism, and democracy on the chopping block. We begin tonight in Russia. Scott Peterson is the Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked him to give us a sense of the scope of the political overhaul outlined by President Putin today.
Well, I think the political magnitude is really quite significant. A lot of these were changes that were expected anyway. They've been in the works for a while. My understanding is that because of the Beslan tragedy that we've had in the last couple of weeks in Russia, the speed of this process has really been moved up. And so today we saw President Vladimir Putin making very, very clear to senior governors, regional governors, and also to security officials that he was going to centralize and control Kremlin's handling of the political situation in Russia and make it just all the more centralized.
And the primary pieces of this would be, can you line them out for us?
Well, one of them is that the 89 regional governors will no longer be elected directly. They will now be nominated by the center, and then they will be endorsed, quote-unquote, by local or regional assemblies. So that's the first thing with the governors. Now, many people say that that's a move that was long overdue anyway, in the sense that some of these regional governorships had actually become kind of personal fiefdoms of these governors, and therefore they'd also become very corrupt and therefore also very ineffective, at least in the view of the Kremlin. So that was one move that was expected and that some people say is not altogether a poor choice. But one of the other elements of this is that for the elections of the State Duma, what the Kremlin is trying to do is deepen its control of the political process by insisting that only the major federal nationwide political parties are able to be elected according to national lists, which basically would squeeze out a lot of the independent candidates that are now inside the Duma. They are the ones that are perennially a thorn in the side of the Kremlin and of the ruling parties. So this is seen as a fairly blatant move to, in that sense, kind of erode that element of the democracy here.
Scott, what was Vladimir Putin's justification for these sweeping measures?
Well, what he's saying and what he's arguing and basically using the aftermath of the Beslan attacks is to say that Russia is facing an unprecedented degree of terrorism, and unless we concentrate power even more into the center in the Kremlin with me, basically, then Russia as a country is not going to be able to survive these attacks. Now, like I said, these were likely to have been steps that would have been taken in the coming months, but it seems that the Kremlin has calculated that in the aftermath of the Beslan tragedy, with the hostage-taking scenario, people are much more open to dramatic political moves, and that's exactly what we saw today.
We're reading reaction from the opposition, such as it is, the political opposition in Russia, just stunned, or else livid but helpless, saying, you know, we're back to the circumstances of the USSR. There's no independent parliament. There's no independent judiciary here now. What kind of reaction are you hearing from political opponents of Putin?
I think that the word that you use that best describes it is helpless. I mean, there really is nothing that they can do. There's nothing that anyone in Russia can do, really, because for the last 4 years, President Putin has built up a system such that basically he, over the last 4 years, has concentrated power increasingly in the hands of the Kremlin. Remember that when he came to power, the previous decade, the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union under Boris Yeltsin, was a very chaotic time. There was very little control. There was an awful lot of laissez-faire. And as a result, there was also an incredible amount of corruption. State assets were ripped off and stolen. And Russians really began to feel relatively insecure. So Putin, even though he's making these moves, he's doing this as a president who has an unprecedented degree of popularity. I mean, some of the popularity ratings for him still rate over 80%, which of course would be a dream for any Western politician. So he's able to make some of these moves, and mask them as saying that these are what's necessary today to take care of the security of Russians.
Is this essentially the end of Russia's democratic experiment? Is it back to the wholly centralized USSR style, in effect?
I think that there are certainly elements of that central control that obviously smack of the Soviet era. But one thing that really must be remembered is that Russians will not tolerate, I don't think, another Soviet system, if you will. Russia has changed so much in the past 14 or 15 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union. It's simply not possible to go back to those days. But on a political level, it is possible to bring back some elements of the Soviet system, such as those that many people say made them feel safer, made them feel more secure. Now, keep in mind that while President Putin is making these steps, which really erode the level of democracy in Russia, at the same time, he's also taking some very, very painful steps to reform the welfare system here, begin to pay people, pensioners and others who have received state assets and goods like electricity and subsidies for hospital care and other things. He's basically forcing them to now accept cash payments, which, of course, people are scared, very scared about, because they feel that those will evaporate
with inflation.
Exactly. And so they are simply not prepared for that. That's a very painful step, but you'll find very few economists who don't think that eventually this step has to be taken because the state's just carrying too many people along with it.
On the political side, though, the public reaction is welcoming, tolerating this?
It's hard to say, and probably too soon to say, in the sense that these decisions were made this morning. If we want to get a taste of what some people's attitudes are, there was a very, very quick 5-minute phone-in poll on Echo Moskvy radio today, which really was very brief. And to be honest, it's not a completely perfect picture because it is a very liberal radio station. In fact, one of the last independent broadcasters in all of Russia, as a matter of fact. And they did a very quick 5-minute poll. They had 3,807 people called in, and 75% of them simply said that governors should be elected directly. That was the vote. It was one way or the other.
That is, should be elected by the people instead of appointed essentially by Putin.
Precisely, precisely.
That hardly sounds like support.
That's right. It does hardly sound like support. But in the context of what Russia has been going through over the last few weeks, which has been this wave of terror attacks, there have been several things that have really shaken people up. People have been demanding action from the Kremlin, and though they have very few ways of expressing their will, questions have been raised, and Putin has been very embarrassed by the fact that the security services here have really been seen to let people down. I mean, there's no hiding the fact that this is a regime. The president, of course, was a former KGB operative, and many of the top people were all members of the Intelligence and Security Committee. So for them to have these kind of security breaches is especially galling.
Scott Peterson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson is the Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me from Moscow. 1 week ago tonight, Marshall Goldman, professor emeritus of Russian economics at Wellesley College, was part of a small group of American scholars that met with Vladimir Putin for 3.5 hours. Goldman says Putin expressed horror at the outcome of the hostage standoff in Beslan, strongly hinting that sweeping changes were in the making. Earlier today, I asked Marshall Goldman in Moscow if Putin's new announcement means that Russia is reverting to Soviet-style centralized authority.
I think it's much the first, heading back to at least aspects of the Soviet-type government. And it's been accelerated by the fact of the terrorism. Putin is very concerned that there are those both within Russia and outside of Russia who are anxious to break it up. And he said that in his speech, and he said that to us, that there is enormous conflict going on. And most important for him is the fact that is that the south of Russia in particular and to the east of Russia, there are no borders. And so it's an open sieve as far as he's concerned.
So when he says people want to break the country up, what's he talking about? Chechnya looks like a pretty small little piece of Russia. Is that, in his mind, an effort to break up the country?
He sees it that way, and I must confess that I thought this was just obstinacy on his part, but I've come to appreciate it a little bit more. The massacre that occurred in Ossetia is a Christian province. The people who...
This is the school massacre not far from Chechnya.
No, that's right. But it wasn't Chechnya so much. It was Ingushetia, which is another one of these mountainous regions, which is predominantly Muslim, Islamic. And there was a war between these two different provinces in 1992. Putin remembers it. There was bloodshed, and he's worried that because the terrorists in this case, a good number of them came from Ingushetia, that the Christians, you know, Ossetia are angry, and that this could set the whole thing aflame. So it's Chechnya, but it's also the fact that you've got like a matrix or checkerboard, if you will, of one part is Islamic, another part is Christian, and they all hate each other. And traditionally, they've hated each other from at least the 17th, 18th, 19th century.
So he's afraid of this entire southern tier going up in flames.
That's right. And given what he sees as outsiders coming in, Arabs, people from Saudi Arabia, wherever it might be. In a sense, he also mentioned this, the explosion that took place after Afghanistan, where we in the United States helped to create these radical fundamentalists who are eager to do this. And they're now going after Russia, he thinks, just like they went out after Afghanistan. And ironically, he blames us in part, although he also acknowledged that Russia, historically in the Soviet era, was a source of terrorism too.
But Marshall, last week when you and I spoke just after the Beslan School massacre, you expressed some skepticism about Vladimir Putin saying there were Arabs among these terrorists. You met with him, and others met with him as well, last week for several hours. What was Putin saying? Did he make a case that I'm hearing persuaded you to some extent?
Well, it persuaded me not so much that outside Arabs were coming in, but he persuaded me that it's at the tinderbox, if you will, and it could be explosive. And he has to maintain control. He's worried that if it spreads there, he said it'll go right up the Volga to Tataristan, then out in further east to Bashkiria, which are Islamic areas. I'm not convinced once it leaves the Northern Caucasus, but it's the Northern Caucasus which he's concerned about. And he says, you know, in the Soviet era, these were all suppressed. Everything was held down. Now that the Soviet Union is gone, there's nobody there but Russians to kind of keep order. And he's fearful that they won't be able to do that. And that's why he's got to find something to do. He can't just stand there. He's got to do something. And one solution is to fire the head of the FSB, the old KGB, but these are his buddies that he came into office with, and he brought there. So he's looking for other things, and that's why now he's basically destroying the democratic process. He's really making it all a rubber stamp, which clearly, in my mind, is not the way to solve the problem. It only exacerbates it.
I mean, but that solution is a nationwide solution, all the way from the borders of Eastern Europe to the Pacific, very far from Chechnya, with essentially at this point no independent press, no independent parliament, no independent judiciary. It seems to take Russia back decades.
Well, that's what I think is happening, and that's, you know, it just didn't happen this past weekend. He's been moving gradually that way, as you suggest, firing journalists who are critical, intimidating businessmen. I met with a banker here in Moscow today. We discussed the meeting with Putin. This man had also met with Putin before. He said, but when those people met with Putin, people who work in Moscow, even though some of them were foreigners, nobody dare raise any hard questions for fear that they would be punished for doing it. He said, well, it's our group. We asked everything under the sun and challenged them about freedom of the press, challenged them about democracy. He has a response. I think in many cases it's simply we were talking two different languages, not just Russian and English. We talk about democracy, and he says, well, democracy in Russia, if you look at what happened in Novgorod, historic Novgorod, the one who persuaded the group was the one who spoke the loudest, not who had the most votes. And that's his conception of democracy. His conception of freedom of the press is only when it's self-sustaining, and you cannot have private owners that are there because they only carry out their own battles. And he no notion of any kind of objectivity or pluralism.
Marshall Goldman, let me ask you this. For decades, the United States struggled with the Soviet Union against its global influence and to bring democracy there. Now, what is the U.S. position? Is all of that being sacrificed with Washington's kind of tacit blessing to the war on terror?
I'm afraid it is because we need their support. Putin also talked about what he was going to do in Iraq. He talked about his friendship with George Bush. This is really kind of odd because the two of them, I must tell you, are very strong and very similar, almost, you know, unwilling to recognize that they may have made a mistake. And when somebody pointed out that a survey in Russia showed that maybe 20% of the Russians supported Kerry, 5% Bush, and 40% didn't care, Putin added, but it's that 5% who are the most influential. There is this strange relationship, and it's going to be very interesting to see if anybody's going to stand up in the administration and say, look, we don't like what you're doing. It's no different than what you did in the Soviet era.
Marshall Goldman, thank you for joining us.
Sure, Tom.
Marshall Goldman is Professor Emeritus of Russian Economics at Wellesley College. He spoke with me from Moscow. We are talking tonight about Russia, terrorism, and democracy. Does a tighter grip by the Kremlin make Russia safer? And what about democracy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about Russia, terrorism, and democracy on a day when Vladimir Putin has ordered sweeping centralization of powers to his own control in the Kremlin in the name of fighting terrorism. You can join the conversation tonight. Does the killing of school children and downing of planes justify the end of Russia's experiment with democracy? Is fighting terrorism being used to justify a return to Soviet-style authoritarianism, or is Putin's consolidation of power justified by the terror threat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I am joined tonight in the studio by Mark Kramer, director of the Harvard Project on Cold War Studies. He's a senior fellow at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. Mark Kramer, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Good to be here, Tom.
And joining us from New York, Stephen Cohen, professor of Russian studies at New York University and author of Failed Crusade, America and the Tragedy of Post-Communist Russia. Stephen Cohen, thank you for joining us this evening.
My pleasure.
Mark Kramer, to you first. Vladimir Putin is expecting this will all be rubber-stamped. It will come to pass. Essentially, there seems to be little doubt about that. Will these changes, this greater and greater centralization of power in the Kremlin, bring security to Russia? Leave democracy, that issue, aside for a moment.
Well, that's the basic problem, is the changes he announced today were very vague on one key point that might deal with terrorism, which has to do with the reorganization of the security apparatus. He said he wanted to create a unified security apparatus. It's very unclear what he means by that, because at present there are a number of security agencies, particularly the so-called Federal Security Service, and then the various departments of the Ministry of Internal Affairs. They have alternated in their control of the counter-terrorist operations and counterinsurgency operations in the Northern Caucasus. But the
Northern Caucasus being the area we're talking about,
Chechnya
and its neighbors.
And mm-hmm. Northern Ossetia Ingushetia mm-hmm. are. And currently, the Ministry of Internal Affairs has overall responsibility. It had rested, though, earlier with the Federal Security Service. So it's unclear what he means by that. That potentially could be an important reform. But again, we don't know what he has in mind there. The other changes, though, the changes dealing with the choosing of parliamentarians, but by now bringing it all through party lists, which guarantees that Putin's own nominal party, the Unity Party, will dominate things even further, plus that he will be appointing governors. Those really seem to me to have absolutely nothing to do with terrorism and everything to do with strengthening Putin's personal control.
Stephen Cohen, how do you see that? If President Bush announced that after a terror attack he was going to start appointing all the governors in America, people would go nuts. In Russia, what do you think the response will be? And does this have anything to do with fighting terror?
The difference is this: Bush has no one with whom to negotiate an end to terror. Putin does. The terror that afflicts Russia today is at least 85-90% political. It derives from the war in Chechnya, which has been going on for a long time. Its essential dynamic is that Chechens, or most of the Chechens, want Russians out of Chechnya. Chechnya mm-hmm. is a part of Russia. And therefore, Putin has, but at least so far as we know, these things sometimes happen secretly, turned his back on the negotiating alternative. That is to say, when he sent Russian troops back into Chechnya in 1999, after a three-year peace, during that three-year peace, the Chechens were permitted by the Yeltsin Kremlin, while remaining part of Russia, to elect their own parliament and president.
Mm-hmm.
Putin overthrew those people, and particularly the president, Maschadov, who is now in the mountains with his men, and has said over and over again, believe him or not, but has said this, I disassociate myself from those Chechens who inflict terror on innocents. And secondly, I am ready to negotiate with the Kremlin, and there's silence from the Kremlin. So that is the alternative. All the other things Putin has done today, I agree with Mark. Even if he thinks they're going to help him fight terrorism, they will not. And we know that not only from Russia, but from the history of these kind of nationalist movements that resort to terrorism. Just remember what happened in Algeria. There was a lot of terrorism in France because the Algerians were sick of being part of France. And in the end, de Gaulle came to power and set them free. And the terrorism ended.
So Mark Kramer, what is going on here? Putin had his emergency cabinet meeting today. It was televised. He said some pretty tough things, even tough on himself. He said, it's not enough for the government to offer tears and words of support. We have achieved practically no visible results in our fight against terror. And, of course, this was his claim to rule, that he would come in and do something about this. So what's really going on? Is it Putin's determination to fight terror that he, through his political lens, sees as part and parcel of an authoritarian government? Or does his urge to centralize government come first and terror is an afterthought?
Well, there's no question that, again, the dramatic nature of the recent spate of terrorist attacks, the most vivid of these and certainly the most horrible was the incident in Beslan. But there was a whole series of attacks within a week or 10 days.
The subway, the airplane, passenger liners coming down.
That's right. Terrorist incidents that in any other country would have also prompted pressure for a vigorous response.
Yeah, but this is taking down the entire political system.
That's right.
It's young and fragile, but now practically gone.
That's right. I, Russia has had many problems since it became an independent country at the end of 1991. Yeltsin obviously did a lot of things that wouldn't comply with what we would regard as norms of democracy either. There were at times that he himself wanted to begin appointing governors again and to centralize control. There was opposition, though, that mounted to that, and each time that he proposed it, he had to back off. Putin, again, after coming to power at the end of 1999 and being elected in March of 2000, was also proposing from a fairly early stage to centralize things. So the way I look on today's changes is not something that just came out of the blue, but instead something that had been in the works for quite a long while and really needed a window of opportunity to pursue it. The thing, though, that has gone on over the past year, and this is why, again, it goes back to a point, Tom, that you made earlier, is that I think there's very little doubt that Putin will get these changes approved. The main reason is that he's done away with any real political opposition in Russia, both by neutralizing any other political parties that were real opponents to what he wanted to do, and by asserting state control over television, and by assuring that the parliament is fully compliant with what he wants.
Pretty much the works there.
Correct.
Stephen Cohen,
can I add another motive that might be at work here?
Yes, please.
I think it is. Putin's not a dumb guy. He knows that these political changes, and as Mark says, these have been underway a long time. Mm-hmm. They aren't going to abet any struggle against terrorism. They're about something else. One of those something else is, I think, that Putin's personal standing in Russia has suffered a very serious blow as a result of these events that Mark described, culminating in the catastrophe.
In Beslan, the school.
Remember how Putin came to power. Remember who he was before. He was a complete unknown, a colonel in the KGB. He came to power on a single platform. I will stop this Chechen terrorism, this Chechen problem.
Yep.
And he uttered a famous statement. We can't quite utter it entirely on your broadcast, but the sanitary version is, we'll track them down and kill them in their outhouses. The problem is all these years later, it's the Chechens who are tracking Russians down and killing them in the toilets. And the Russian people know this.
Oh, okay. So
now, the problem here is this for Putin. His public image, his political profile, his biography as the tough guy who can assert order has been dealt the blow, not only among ordinary people, but within the bureaucracy.
Right.
Bureaucrats in Russia are deferential to strong leaders. When they perceive the leader is weak, they begin to go their own way. I see, in part, these sort of pseudo-tough measures that Putin's taken today as an attempt to buffer up his public image as a tough guy, as a resolute terror fighter. Their practical consequences, I think, for fighting terrorism are virtually zero. But their consequences, as both of you said, for the Russian political system and possibly for the way Putin rules are important. It seems to me that Putin's the cult of Putin, which has driven this astonishing popularity of nearly 70% for all these years, has suffered a blow, and Putin can no longer rule the country as he has done during these last 5 or so years.
Well, it raises all kinds of issues, not least how the United States ought to be reacting to this. But we have callers who want to join us. I want to begin to invite them in. John is calling from Quincy, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make the comparison of what Putin is doing to what Bush did after 9/11, which is to take advantage politically of the fear and public destabilization that terrorism causes to push through what he wanted to do anyway, which was, first of all, the Patriot Act, most of the provisions of which weren't tied to the weaknesses of 9/11, but more importantly, the attack on Iraq, which clearly they was premeditated.
So you may see a parallel there, John, perhaps. But what if there is, what's the significance of that parallel in your mind?
Well, I think it's just political leaders taking advantage of terrorism for their own political gain or own political objectives. And I think in this case, it has to do with internal politics in Russia, that's been discussed. But I also feel that it has to do with the external relationship with the U.S., because by doing it in this way and linking these actions to terrorism, there's no effective response that Bush can make in opposition. He cannot come down and say, no, this is undemocratic. You can't do this.
John, we've got it. Thanks very much for your call. Mark Kramer, what about this relationship in this dynamic of the umbrella of the war on terror? Putin has been relatively supportive of George Bush. What's the United States' position now when the goal of decades in the United States, democracy in Russia, seems to be flying away on the wings of counterterrorism?
Well, the United States, again, for quite a long while, but particularly since September 2001, has been very low-key in what it says about Chechnya. I don't want to excuse what Chechen terrorists have done, and there are terrorists. There are also, though, what I would regard as genuine insurgents, which would probably constitute the bulk of those who have resisted Russian domination in Chechnya. And the Russians have fought it with indiscriminate brutality, have destroyed almost the entire infrastructure of Chechnya, have laid waste to the region, have killed about 60,000 people, have so-called disappeared people, that is, they are swept up in the night and never come back.
As ugly as it could be, all right.
Has resorted to torture and the like. So the United States has said almost nothing about that in recent years. There have been a couple of mild protests here and there, but for the most part has given Putin a free ride on this. Now, whether this latest move, just given what it will mean for any future potential for democracy in Russia, I don't know. I hope that there is more than just a token protest, but I wouldn't count on it, because at this point, U.S. policy toward Russia seems so driven by the desire to have Russia at least not oppose what the United States is doing vis-a-vis Iraq and in the war on terrorism.
Stephen Cohen, what's your view here? Our caller, John, says he sees parallels between Putin and Bush, perhaps, but the bigger issue would seem to me to be the United States spent so many years pushing to see the Soviet Union, now Russia, go in a different direction. Is all of that just being sent down the river in the war on terror? Does that matter?
Does it matter to us or to Russians?
Well, does it matter to the United States? Does it matter to the global dynamic, the march of freedom that President Bush talks about?
Let's put everything in context. Something unprecedented is happening in Russia. For the first time in history, a fully nuclearized country, that's Russia, there are only two in the world, Russia and the United States, is coming apart at the seams, and has been coming apart at the seams for more than a decade, nearly 13 years since the end of the Soviet Union. Never before have there been a civil war in a nuclear country. Never before has there been systematic terrorism in a nuclear country. We can't rule out, in fact, perhaps we should rule in the possibility that these Chechen terrorists, who are enormously clever and professional, they can carry out their mission, might strike soon at a nuclear reactor in Russia. So, of course, it matters what happens in Russia to all of us. Another context.
Could I add quickly, Steve, on that?
Clear, yeah.
It was interesting that in the immediate aftermath of the Beslan massacre, that Russia took steps to strengthen security around its nuclear sites.
Yeah, Mark, it did. So it's aware of this.
That's a good point, Mark. I don't know what your reaction was, but my first reaction when I heard that was, why hadn't they done that?
I know. That was my reaction, too.
Yeah. But the other thing, to give us a little, and particularly your listeners, I think most of them of a certain age, you don't have to be too much of a certain age to remember this, is that in March next year, it'll be the 20th anniversary of Gorbachev coming into power and beginning what was known as Perestroika, which led to the very democratization that you are now asking us about. That is the 20-year experiment in Russia, first ever, with democracy, dying or dead? It's been dying for a long time, as Mark pointed out, even before Putin. But I would direct your attention to the essential heartbeat that may be crushed. Russia has always had, under czars and commissars, strong executive power. Czars, commissars, general secretaries.
Right, presidents. That's the history.
It has never had a self-sustaining, autonomous, durable, strong parliament or legislative branch. What exists in Russia today is already a puppet parliament. Putin wants to make it, I don't know what, I can't quite think of the word, but a super puppet parliament even more by eliminating electoral districts and making
all about the party.
Party lists. So the thing to look at, in my judgment, yes, freedom of the press, yes, Putin's attempt to bring more power to himself, but if you want to ask yourself and your listeners want to track the fate of democracy in Russia, watch what happens to this parliament. Will it survive? And one last point. It didn't begin in 2004. It began in 1993 when Yeltsin sent tanks against an elected parliament,
right,
an almost unprecedented event in the history of Europe. That was the beginning of the end of the parliamentary experiment. Now, it's not dead, and people in Russia need to struggle. And the people who call themselves Democrats in Russia bear some of the responsibility for what is now happening. They embraced Putin when he came to power. They were looking for a Pinochet, not a Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And now they're complaining because it's gone much farther than they thought it would. One of the questions is, will they fight back? Are they frightened? Is there space for them to fight? We will see.
I mean, it's hard to imagine how they would. The independent press is essentially gone. The opposition.
The press isn't, but the television.
Television. Excuse me.
And remember, Russia is the largest territorial country in the world. Regional television, local television, local newspapers. All these exist. They are fearful, but they are not under the kind of censorship that existed during the high Soviet period. And there is still room to fight, but the fight may be gone out of the people who believe in democracy. I'm not sure. My own friends who call themselves Democrats, they know they are partly responsible for what's happened. And now they're at a psychological turning point. Do they throw up their hands and say, well, that's Russia for you. We never had a chance. And blame the people, which is what many of them do. Or they say, no, we're responsible. We need to fight. We'll see.
Stephen Cohen, Mark Kramer, we're going to take a short break. We're talking about Russia, terrorism, and democracy. You can join the conversation. Will political consolidation make Russia safer or make it a pressure cooker? Should the U.S. support Putin in his power grab? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Russia, terrorism, and democracy on a day when Vladimir Putin has ordered sweeping centralization of powers to his own control in the name of fighting terrorism. My guests tonight are Mark Kramer, director of the Harvard Project on Cold War Studies at Harvard University, and from New York, Stephen Cohen, professor of Russian Studies at New York University. You can join the conversation tonight. Has Washington's war on terror rhetoric empowered Vladimir Putin to end democracy? Are security and democracy at odds in Russia? What about globally? Is Washington sanctioning this perception with silence? Or when school children die, does anything go politically? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tim is calling from Heartland, Wisconsin. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Yeah, good afternoon or good evening.
Good to have you, Tim.
Say, I've done some senior-level military-to-military, civilian-to-civilian consulting in former Eastern Bloc countries.
Okay.
And one of the things that comes up, which has implications for this discussion, I think, is the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, and many of the former Soviet Bloc countries don't seem to get things right because they can't think except in a centralized model. That is to say, they wait at the local level for something to come down from some higher level. And it gets in the way of the independent kind of decision-making and kind of boots on the ground, handle a situation right now, ingenuity that is sort of the genius of the United States historically.
But if that's what Russians are waiting for, then does it make sense to centralize in the Kremlin? Is it the right step that Putin's taken today?
Well, no, what I'm saying is that they're looking for ways to figure it out differently. They're looking to figure things out on their own at local levels. They don't think that way. They're not accustomed to thinking that way. So I think it's understandable that he would be doing what he's doing. When people are frightened, they want, you know, clear, authoritative models. But long term, one of the things that made the whole thing fall apart is that the central system really doesn't allow for independent thinking at a local level, which is very important relative to things like terrorism. That's something, you know, individuals have to be vigilant and take charge.
Leaving a kind of disempowered, maybe even self-disempowered population. Stephen Cohen, Tim, thank you for your call. Stephen Cohen, I mean, it brings up these enormous issues. There were so many years of hope and effort by the United States to see Russia go in a new direction. Are we seeing today just sort of another step toward a reality that Russia is not going to be a democracy, period? That's just the way it goes? Or is this simply a different kind of democracy than the United States anticipated, hoped for?
You talking to me or to Mark?
Stephen, please, you.
I can only say what I said before. I don't think this story is yet at an end. There are people who believe in Russia and in the West and in the profession to which Mark and I belong, who believe that what the last 20 years show us is that Russians aren't suited for democracy. They don't get it. They can't do it. There's something in the culture or the genetic code that makes Russians deferential to despots, and they don't respect and protect their democratic institutions, like the parliament I mentioned before. That is not my view. I think Russians, or at least the Russians I've come to know over 40 years of traveling in Russia, are just as capable of being democratic as we are. The problem, I think, is within the Russian political elite. This elite, it was partly the way the Soviet Union was broken up. When the Soviet Union broke up, and by the way, Mark's about to publish a book on this, so I'll be very careful what I say. But when the Soviet Union broke up, property flew in the air. Billions and billions of dollars worth of assets, from oil to automobiles to buildings to television stations. And the elite began to chase property. And property became far more important to the elite than democracy. Once it got the property, it no longer felt secure because it knew it hadn't gotten it legitimately. So it became fearful of democracy. Now, that's a simplistic interpretation, and it's only one factor. But what I want to do is direct the thinking of your listeners to the role of the Russian political elite and away from blaming the Russian people. So I would say to you that if the elite itself, those people, as I said before, who still remain committed to democracy, don't quit, then the story's not over.
Still a chance.
No, I would agree with what Steve has said, and just to indicate, you know, again, why I have a good deal of faith in the Russian people is, if you look at some of the recent opinion polls, they do show, to go back to the issue that Steve was discussing earlier about the possibility of negotiations about Chechnya, that Russians overwhelmingly favor an effort to negotiate a political solution. About 68% to 70% or so favor dealing with separatist leaders in Chechnya, not with terrorists, but with separatist leaders. That's an option that Putin has consistently rejected. He has held out the possibility a couple of times in the past, but has always backed away from it. So if the problem, I think, comes from the leaders that the Russian people have had, and that Russians, looking at the way things changed during the Gorbachev period, I was amazed not at that Russians weren't able to get acclimated to democracy, but just how quickly they did it and how much they accomplished.
So the tone in a number of calls you've had this evening, or the question, the comment is, let's put it as a question, has Washington's posture on the war on terror and the Bush administration's posture, is it turning out to be a kind of enabler of Putin's consolidation of power away from that potential democratic impulse that you're citing, Stephen Cohen?
Well, let me give you a slight, I mean, maybe yes, maybe no, but let me give you what I think is the larger problem.
Okay.
Now, here, Mark and I may go our separate ways. I am a very strong critic of American policy toward Russia, as it's been going back to the Clinton period. It's not just a matter of Bush, but it's continued under Bush. What's happened is that this constant forward movement of American and NATO military force toward Russia, and now the encirclement of Russia from the Baltics to the Caucasus to Central Asia,
right,
with American and NATO troops, what that has done, in my judgment, is basically destroy the pro-Western, pro-democratic lobby in the Russian political elite. And therefore, the lobbyists for democracy in Russia who have the authority and the power to act on that, to be democratic at the top, we, the United States, I believe, have cut their legs off. And we have left in their place people who have a very different attitude toward the West and toward the Russian political system. Now, is that to blame just the United States for what's happened? No. But I think that's been more important than this American silence about Chechnya, because I don't think it really mattered one way or the other.
Mark Kramer, 1 minute left. The American influence on Russia's political direction here.
Well, two points. One is that I think the United States does have an influence by the example it sets. And here I think that over the last 2 to 3 years, the United States has not always set the best example, that some of the measures that have been taken have given the Russians an excuse. I mean, I could cite any number of things, but particularly the extraordinary secrecy that the Bush administration has promoted. So in that sense, I think the United States has not set a good example. U.S. policy and U.S. objections to Russian conduct, I would agree, I think have only a marginal impact at best. Nonetheless, it does, I think, behoove the U.S. government to raise objections when Russia is moving so dramatically away from democracy, when it's conducting a brutal policy in Chechnya, and to say nothing, I think, does ultimately give the Russian government a carte blanche.
And with that, we are out of time. Mark Kramer, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Mark Kramer of Harvard and Stephen Cohen at New York University, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Stephen Cohen, author of Failed Crusade, America and the Tragedy of Post-Communist Russia. In a moment, the assault weapons ban goes by the boards. This is On Point. Midnight last night marked the expiration of the 10-year-old federal assault weapon ban. 19 types of semi-automatic weapons, including AK-47s, Tech-9s, and Uzis, can now be legally sold in the United States. The 1994 ban had many loopholes, and studies done by both pro- and anti-gun control groups showed mixed results on whether the ban helped reduce crime around the country. But a new poll by the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication found 68% of Americans favored extending the assault weapons ban. I spoke with Kristen Rand, legislative director at the Violence Policy Center, a gun control advocacy group based in Washington that has been critical of the 1994 federal ban. I asked her what was lost in the lapsing of the assault weapons ban today.
The gun industry has very successfully evaded the 1994 ban, so really not that much is lost except for an opportunity to not only renew but significantly strengthen the ban, and that is what our organization has been advocating.
You've been critical of this ban for the last 10 years as Swiss cheese in the gun industry for end-running it in many ways. You want much tougher gun control laws, like what?
We want an effective assault weapons ban like the one they have in California. California saw the problems with their ban they originally passed in 1989 and updated it in 1999, and it bans assault weapons. It's been very effective, and we need to use that as a national model.
What do you mean, then, when you say assault weapons? It gets used in so many ways.
An assault weapon is either a pistol, rifle, or shotgun that incorporates specific design characteristics that make it more lethal on the battlefield. That's why assault weapons exist, is because regular firearms prove not lethal enough, not rapid fire enough, not concealable and portable enough on the battlefield. And so they were developed specifically for that use. And what we need to do is identify all weapons that fall into that category and ban them from civilian use.
And you have said that despite the ban of the last 10 years, lots of assault weapons have continued to be manufactured and used, and you have found that in the deaths of law enforcement, that is quite evident.
Yes, assault weapons have continued to be mass-produced in America. We estimate that more than 1 million have been domestically produced since the 1994 law took effect. And unfortunately, those guns have taken their toll on law enforcement. We looked at FBI data for the years 1998 through 2001 and found that during that time period, 1 out of 5 law enforcement officers slain in the line of duty was killed with an assault weapon. And just this year, we've already seen 6 officers fall to assault weapons. In Alabama, they had one incident where 3 were killed at the same time. And this really demonstrates the urgent public safety need to institute an effective assault weapons ban.
Kristen, you're legislative director there at the Violence Policy Center. Your center is very pro-gun control. You've been a skeptic about this particular ban. But you know, and we heard it again today, the lamenting, the rending of garments and gnashing of teeth about the passing of this. Many people are really upset about it, including police chiefs, I should point out. How do you interpret how committed people were to this legislation, how upset they profess to be with its passing when you say it's been so ineffective?
Well, I think most Americans believe what we have an assault weapons ban, and the fact of the matter is we don't. But I think it shows the level of intensity of support for the concept of banning assault weapons. You know, I think police don't want to go back to the days in 1994 where we had record firearms violence rates and the assault weapons were more of a daily problem. And that's why you hear law enforcement speaking out so effectively. But I think when they take the time to really sit down and look at what are the models of guns that are killing our officers, they're going to be the most vocal proponents of an effective ban.
President Bush did not step in to encourage the extension of this ban, whatever its faults. How do you read the politics going forward? The Republican-controlled Congress, the Republican White House, at least for now, and the NRA, is there any chance of an assault weapons ban in the United States despite widespread public support?
Well, I think the failure to act on a ban is going to backfire on the president, and I think primarily because its expiration has focused law enforcement on the hazard that these guns present to their officers. And I think, unfortunately, we're starting to see a trend of officers being gunned down with these weapons, not just 1 at a time, but 2 and 3 at a time. And it's going to become a real public safety crisis. And I think the future is law enforcement is going to eventually force Congress to act. And I think the president, unfortunately, is on the wrong side of this one.
But when you put the muscle of law enforcement up against the muscle of the National Rifle Association, who wins?
In the past, law enforcement wins. We had the same battle when we were fighting to restrict armor-piercing ammunition. The police won that battle. The police won the battle over the original ban, the original assault weapons ban, even though it proved to not be very effective. They won that political battle. The law enforcement community generally gets what they want most out of Congress, and I think this is going to become a much more important issue for them in the near future.
Kristen Rand, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Kristen Rand is Legislative Director of the Violence Policy Center. She spoke with me from Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.